Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Saleri Report. John and I are recording on March 20th, Wednesday, for publication tomorrow on March 21st. I'd like to point out, John, March 22nd is Saleri's anniversary. It's a propitious week.
It's great.
Our theme this week is
TikTok till a big event.
Yeah.
TikTok's in the news, and it's in the news for some of the right reasons, but not all the reasons. It's like, what is going on? What are you guys up to?
Squeeze play. Where, you know, this is squeeze play. From the moment Trump locked up the nomination, you know, the boys are now out on squeeze play, and it's going to get much, much stronger. So let's dive in.
Yeah. Let's dive in. And we'll start with genocide in Gaza, which, as this week illustrates, is increasingly becoming a domestic U.S. issue.
Right.
So let's get into it. With the first story from Reuters, Israel approves plan to attack Rafah, but keeps truce hopes alive. Really, same old here. Israel approved a potential assault on the Gaza city of Rafah while also keeping ceasefire hopes alive with a plan to send another delegation for talks and a hostage deal. Netanyahu said he'd okay to plan to attack the city on the southern edge of the shattered Palestinian enclave, where more than half of its 2.3 million residents are sheltering, so civilians. Global allies and critics alike have urged Netanyahu to hold off attacking Rafah, fearing mass civilian casualties. And this is where the same old comes in. Israel, totally ignoring the ICJ ruling that says it's committing genocide, rejects claims of genocide, saying it's purely focused on destroying all Hamas fighters. As for Washington, there's increasing friction, which officials in Joe Biden's administration say is waging war with too little care for civilians, even as the Biden administration continues to supply weapons to Israel. So it's talking out of both sides of the mouth.
Right. So the U.S. could shut it down right away if they wanted, I'm assuming. Right. So they're not. Now, here's what was interesting to me. Schumer says he wants Netanyahu gone. If you look at the sentence after the... Now, that's unprecedented for Schumer to say. And the question is he sincere? Is it just part of this game of trying to look like they're not approving what he's doing? Right.
It's the next level of the game of bad faith, mealy-mouthed talk.
Right. So the U.S. is pretending that they're against what Israel is doing, but they're facilitating and making everything possible.
Follow the do-re-mi and you'll see the truth. And the truth is,
right.
No. We're funding it. We're behind it.
Right.
Yep.
Well, but it's interesting. 80% of people in Israel say they want Netanyahu gone. Schumer says he wants Netanyahu gone. But for some reason, Netanyahu can magically stay in place.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. It's like the Matrix. The guy just is dodging all these bullets coming at him in slow motion. Like, wow, that's remarkable.
Oh, but he's willing to play the bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's his role in this in this play. That's his role.
Right.
Right. So the genocide's continuing apace with the U.S. backing, with full U.S. backing. Okay. Let's turn to where this starts to get domestic. And that's illustrated in this next story. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb signs proclamation condemning anti-Semitism while vetoing bill defining it. Indiana Governor Holcomb vetoed a bill Monday that would have defined anti-Semitism in state education codes while simultaneously signing a proclamation condemning all forms of anti-Semitism. So, you know, there's a proclamation, but there's no teeth to it, basically. The bill's opponents argued that early versions of the bill would penalize people, here's the key, for criticizing Israel. Yeah, that's what the bill is about. Around the country, including South Dakota, and Kristi Noem, similar legislation rose to prominence this session amid the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. So that's what this is really all about. The anti-Semitism definition is hopelessly vague. It's a certain perception of Jews, which may or may not be expressed as hatred toward Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish community institutions and religious facilities, or really to Israel. And I want to cut to a clip to give subscribers an idea of how fluid this definition is. Let's take a look at this clip. There we go. And watch this. The feuded phrase here is hag, H-A-G, hag.
And how dare you go into the misogynistic, the anti-Semitic trope of his hag daughter, something used throughout the late 18th and early through the early 20th century.
Sorry. Hag is now anti-Semitic?
So that is a term of his hag daughter that goes back into the witches of Eastern Europe. Why did you have to call her a hag daughter?
Just
tell
to be
me
clear,
that.
Because she's a witch. I think she's a witch. That's not because she's Jewish.
Right,
I would call someone a hag of any color. I think she's a witch. What they have done over the last two years. I believe his daughter is a hag. I said that because that's what I believe. You may disagree with me on that, but to say that that's anti-Semitic is ridiculous. I would call any person a hag.
Candace?
There you go. Hag is anti-Semitic.
I spent 45 minutes yesterday trying to understand the definitions. Right. And they've been very, you know, the definition you read has been very fluid. We had the EU try and, you know, define something and then it got changed, you know. And so the controversy over the exact language and the evolution of the language keeps changing. But you're right. And then it's just unbelievably vague. And so anything can be included.
Yeah. So the notion is, if you criticize Israel, you criticize this genocide, you call it a genocide, you're anti-Semitic, and you're guilty of a hate crime. That's what is at issue here.
Yeah, and I think there's something else at issue, because what I'm seeing, and we'll get into this when it's happening with TikTok, I started in 2017 to warn that the big investors from the Harvard endowment on down were teeing up accelerating disaster capitalism. So the pandemic, you shut down Main Street and then you start picking them up cheek. And you can do that because there's a wealth of Fed money injecting into the economy. And so it's a disaster capitalism game. And part of what is happening is you're trying to tee up these hate crimes so that when that game accelerates, nobody can object. Because somebody...
Right. Right.
Somebody playing games to shut down my economy and pick me off cheap and grab my land is somehow, my objection to that is a hate crime. And so
right. If
you look at the game of trying to shut down the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, and institute lots of hate crimes, this is in anticipation of a wave that's underway and is going to is accelerating. And we'll see that in what's happening with TikTok.
Yeah, and exactly. We're going to see that in a couple stories. So the TikTok connection is very, very interesting, and it's an angle that media is really not covering. But let's, by way of background, let's cut to a story from earlier this year about Steve Mnuchin, because he's involved. He's a central player, an integral player in the TikTok story. But back in January, we had this story from the Jerusalem Post. Other people covered it, too. Time to invest in Israel, says former U.S. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. The two key paragraphs are here. Mnuchin came to Israel on a business trip for the first time since October 7th massacre with his business partner, former U.S. Ambassador David Friedman. The two men who served under Trump started the Liberty Strategic Fund in 2021, and they have an office in Tel Aviv. The fund has $3 billion. And then the second is really here. Mnuchin said the fund recently increased its interest in defense software for the genocide, including a company it learned about before the war, whose tech is now being used on the battlefield. I find that nugget very interesting. The Mnuchin's knee deep in Israel on military technology, and now he's involved in TikTok.
So Netanyahu has been a leader for a long, long time in promoting Israel as the tech center of the world. You know, sort of the Middle East, Silicon Valley. And Whitney Webb has done a lot of disclosure about how that group has been an integral part of contracting in the United States for the U.S. government. And we could have a whole show just on that topic of what they've been doing over the last 2 years to insert themselves into the global infrastructure of the control grid. So think of this as the control grid. It's not just war, it's money. So they've been a leader in Bitcoin and crypto, And one of the things I realized watching this game around TikTok is, you know, I've been assuming that the Gaza genocide is we need the land, Europe needs the oil and gas, you know, we're finally going to clean this out. But one of my questions is, if they're looking to run major IT and cybersecurity infrastructure from Israel, do they just want to clean the whole place out? And do they need lots of land for the increased capacity? Just like Silicon Valley had the problem of getting more land as they brought things back into the United States, does Israel have a problem with needing more capacity for playing this IT role? And if they do, is how much of that role relates to, the CBDC and the financial control grid? That's a question. I don't know the answer. But
right.
This is all beginning to look very suspicious. And let's keep going, because what Mnuchin is up to, basically a game that is launched as soon as Trump locks up the Republican nomination.
Right. That's a great point. This doesn't start coming out until Trump locks up the nomination. And Mnuchin was his Treasury Secretary.
Right. They do the run on the Community Development Bank of New York. That was two weeks ago. That's a very strategic location, given the business that bank's in.
It's a big bank, too.
Right. And now Mnuchin's going after TikTok.
Yes. Okay. So let's get into that. There's a video from the Wall Street Journal. I've converted the video to a slideshow because that's really what the video was. And it's shorter. So there's six slides. Here you see Mnuchin. He's putting together a consortium to try to buy TikTok. Okay. His comments came a day after the House passed a bill that would ban TikTok from operating in the U.S. or force a sale of the app. That's really what's going on here. Next up, the app faces scrutiny over the way its algorithm selects content on sensitive and contentious issues like the Israel-Hamas war. How about it? So really, the powers that be aren't happy with its algos. It's like you need more like YouTube algos that really filter stuff out. Here you have the AstroTurf opponents to the bill, all with the same sign, same font, everything. Opponents to the bill say the ban raises free speech concerns. You know, maybe that's misdirection, maybe not. ByteDance, just so we're clear on ByteDance, it's a Chinese outfit, would have less than 6 months from the enactment of the bill to divest TikTok. You'll see the significance of 6 months in a minute. Or the app will be banned from app stores and web hosting services in the U.S. So 6 month time frame to shut down or sell. And Biden said he's going to sign the bill if it gets to his desk. Undoubtedly, he will.
So let's look who owns ByteDance. ByteDance is owned 20% by its founders and Chinese. So we have 20% Chinese investment. We have 20% is owned by the employees. And 60% is owned by a group of essentially U.S. LBO and private equity firms, including KKR. So the big bad Chinese here are not Chinese, they're KKR. So you're talking about a company that is owned and essentially controlled by, a group of four or five of huge American LBO and private equity firms. So the notion that this is somehow a Chinese company is ridiculous.
Right. And you saw the journal making two attempts there with the protesters who are largely Chinese. And the ByteDance sticks to the Chinese character. They're pushing a China angle real hard.
Oh, you wouldn't believe it. I started to talk to friends about this, and I was appalled. They really thought this was owned and controlled by the Chinese government. I said, wait a minute, this is owned and controlled by, the likes of KKR. What are you talking about? Anyway, so if you look at the squeeze play, we have a huge attack on the First Amendment. And the money on both sides of it is big U.S. private equity money, right?
Right. Well, we'll get to the free speech part in a bit.
Right.
What we just touched on is there is undeniably an Israeli connection with TikTok, both through Mnuchin and through the motivation for shutting down TikTok, which is we don't like criticism of what Israel's doing in Gaza.
Well, for the last year, I keep being told by just about everybody I know who uses social media that the best access to information is available through TikTok. Right. So you've got the private equity guys on both sides who want to play the disaster capitalism game, and they need laws and they need regulations that will protect them, you know, when they continue and accelerate their rape. So to me, this is simply, we don't see it all clearly, but this is simply a game to shut down free speech.
Yeah. And if it's going to start with TikTok, and I'm speaking of good information, I've learned a lot about the war in Ukraine through Telegram videos.
Right.
You know, so they're you're next, Telegram.
Right.
You're right. Next.
Everybody's next.
Yeah.
Everybody's next. Right.
Right. Right. Okay. Let's turn to FedWatch. And we're going to start off by following up on a story we covered last week, which is the alleged suicide of Barnett, the witness, the whistleblower witness against Boeing. And now we've since last week, evidence has surfaced that it was not a suicide. So let's just cut to, I've got a video queued up, ready to go here, from a local news outfit that covers one of Barnett's friends, who says not a suicide.
First tonight, our investigative reporter Ann Emerson has new information in the death of Boeing whistleblower John Barnett. A close family friend of Barnett says he predicted he might wind up dead, that a story could surface that he killed himself. But he told her, don't believe it. Ann?
Tessa, Barnett's family friend Jennifer said they had talked about this exact scenario playing out, but his words seemed like a premonition. He told her, don't ever believe it.
I knew John because his mom and my mom are best friends. And so over the years, get-togethers, birthdays, celebrations, and, you know, whatnot, we've all got together and talked and, you know, that's how we really know each other.
And when Jennifer needed help one day, Barnett came by to see her. They talked about his upcoming depositions in Charleston. Jennifer knew he filed an extremely damaging complaint against Boeing. He says the aerospace giant retaliated against him when he blew the whistle on unsafe practices. For more than 30 years, Barnett was a quality manager. He'd recently retired and moved back to look after his mom in Louisiana.
He wasn't concerned about safety because I asked him, I said, aren't you scared? And he said, and his voice and the way he would talk, no, I ain't scared. He said, but if anything happens to me, it's not suicide. You know, I know that he did not commit suicide. There's no way. He loved life too much. He loved his family too much. He loved his brothers too much to put them through what they're going through right now.
Wow.
Wow. That's clear.
Yeah. That's pretty compelling. Someone's saying there's no way.
So I told you,
there's no rebuttal evidence whatsoever. There's no other witness saying, oh no, he was depressed. You know, he's taking all these meds. I got nothing.
So there have been more bad headlines about Boeing. I told you I watched a video that someone made of the engineering department at a Boeing plant that was putting out one of their planes. There were 15 engineers in the group, and the person who made the video claimed that 10 had said they would never fly this plane, and they played one saying, you know, I would never fly in this plane, it's not safe. And then they said 5 said they would, but one said he had suicidal tendencies, and that's why he would, you know, making a joke. But
wow.
The implication was very profound, because you're saying you've got a department of 15 engineers who know how bad it is, and they continue to work there and take a paycheck, even knowing that, with 10 of them who would never fly that plane. And I wanted to mention Kayak now. Apparently, when you go in, Kayak is one of the websites you use to make travel arrangements. You go in, you can screen for only Airbus planes. So you can screen out any flight that has a Boeing plane.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you want to cut to the stock chart of Boeing and Airbus?
Yep. Let's take a look at the stock chart.
Okay. Like, this is kind of amazing.
Okay. So this is year to date. So Airbus is up 17%. The S&P is up 9%. The aerospace and defense sort of industry group is up 2%. And there is Boeing all the way down at, let's see.
The basement dweller at minus 28%.
Right. And if we looked at that chart over the 5-year period, it would get even worse. So, you know, clearly Boeing has, as we talked about last week, a serious Paul O'Neill problem. And that's a problem that's you can't fix that quickly. That is a seriously ingrained cultural problem. And I don't see how they get out of this, John.
I don't either. But it's a top-down problem. And let's go to a story that basically summarizes Boeing's ills. It's from Zero Hedge. Where Boeing went wrong. It's a quick summary. And it's nothing subscribers of Solari don't already know, I think. I can explain Boeing quickly. The merger with McDonnell Douglas got huge, got new management, emphasized financial chicanery over top flight engineering, symbolized in its corporate move of its corporate headquarters from Seattle to Chicago, which I, John Titus, remember very well. The financial geniuses then worked to break the union, shift production from trained Seattle workforce to untrained workforces in places like South Carolina, and outsource production of plane components. The end result, lower quality of aircraft, delays in development, and fatalities from crashes. But rest assured, management in Chicago did very well. Sure did. Meanwhile, by focusing on MBAs and JDs rather than engineers, top management fell victim to all the pathologies coming out of those top schools where nonsense like DEI comes from. That about summarizes, but you're exactly right. This notion of I'm going to get mine and it's okay and I don't really care what I'm doing because I'm getting mine because I'm smart, that's really a poisonous notion that is really I saw take hold during the bailouts. People are like, well, it's smart to have these big banks because, you know, if you hurt the big banks, you're going to hurt us, and I can't do that.
Right.
You're slitting your own throat.
Right. You're watching an economy, and this is because of the financial methadone. The more money that's spent with a political agenda, the more it crowds out economic market discipline. And so now we have an economy where you can't make money on manufacturing and you financialize everything and enormous amounts of money are being sucked out. And with this much federal largesse spending on projects which are not economic, the whole economy becomes more and more dependent on the financial game. And that's what we're watching. So
that's what we're watching. Yep.
There's a huge day of reckoning coming in America over the infrastructure spending because we've had 3 decades of financial federal subsidy into infrastructure that the municipalities can't afford to maintain. It's not economic. You don't have a private, you've wiped out enough private economy. There's no private economy to fund the taxes to pay the maintenance of all this stuff.
Let me push back a little bit on huge day of reckoning. I think it's 3 decades. It's the huge day of reckoning is here, and it's been here for 30 years. If you could be in a time machine.
We're in the reckoning. Yeah. We're in the reckoning of this accumulated game of running the economy for central control as opposed to efficiency or optimization. And it's not economic.
Right.
Right. And it's one of the reasons we've decided to basically, you know, whether it's by inflation or the great poisoning, we've decided to cull the herd because we can't afford the promises that we've made.
Yes.
Right.
Right. Right. And we don't care how we do it.
Well, the people leading it don't care how they do it. I care how they do it. You care how they do it.
Yeah, I care very much. But, you know, the powers that be do not.
This is why, remember when I said these guys are coming in for the kill and the disaster capitalism is accelerating? This is why there is an enormous economic imperative for them to accelerate this game.
And what is that? Why now?
Well, because the fundamental economics are causing a fundamental implosion. So either they come in and re-engineer and clean it up, or they're going to lose control. So it's double down or lose control.
Yeah, I think that the best expression of that is probably in the U.S. debt, which is going up astronomically right now.
Right.
Parabolically is a better term.
Right. So the grab for the real assets is on.
I think that's right.
Right.
Because remember, all debt is counter in a debt-based monetary system. where there is debt, there is collateral somewhere.
Okay. Well, here's the question. Who's gonna take on LBOing Boeing?
I think we just saw it. It's going to be Airbus. It's going to eat them up.
Right. Okay. Yep.
Okay, let's keep it going with free speech. Arguments in front of the Supreme Court yesterday, oral arguments. But let's go to a backstory by Matt Taibbi. Taibbi's the Daily Double this week. But this is the first of two pieces by Taibbi from Racket News, Taibbi's outlet, on today's absurd New York Times hit piece, the hit piece being on Taibbi. This is a couple points worth considering here. The story kind of centers a Times story on former Trump administration official Mike Benz, who the Times is sort of plumping as this demonic Darth Vader type figure who's controlling all these strings. But the backstory on the censorship and the Twitter files is a number of writers, Schellenberger, Barry Weiss, Lee Fang, and other Twitter files reporters discovered key elements of the Twitter files reports from industry calls held between the FBI and internet platforms like Twitter. They'd also discover the role of Stanford's Election Integrity Partnership and the role of the State Department's Global Engagement Center in sponsoring anti-disinformation work in the first 2 weeks of our research. Our central thesis about state-sponsored censorship was online months before we met Darth Vader Benz. Okay? As I wrote, Taibbi, in Christmas Eve 2022, the Twitter files show the FBI acting as a doorman to a vast program of social media surveillance and censorship encompassing agencies across the federal government, from the State Department to the Pentagon to the CIA. The operation is far bigger than the reported 80 members of the Foreign Influence Task Force. Twitter had so much contact with so many agencies that executives lost track. Nevertheless, the gist of today's Times piece, hit piece, is that Schellenberger and I got this thesis piece. We got it from Benz. That Benz was the mastermind behind all of this, even though we were writing about it beforehand. So that's one point. The other point here is that the Times didn't even bother trying to argue that we got anything wrong. It just said we knew Benz, showed a picture of him sitting behind Schellenberger as he testified, and then said things like, more recently, Benz originated the false assertion that Taylor Swift was a psychological operation asset for the Pentagon. So that story is interesting because, A, They try to make it a left-right issue when it's not left-right. B, they never take anything up on the merits. They just go right to the implications. And C, this Benz character is kind of used to blackwash Taibbi and other legit writers. In other words, they tie them together. They have Benz go out on a limb with this Taylor Swift nonsense. Then they import that and impute that to Taibbi and other people. That's a really interesting points he's making there.
Right. So what he's saying is the Times is writing hit pieces. It has no interest in the fundamental issue. And as someone who was once upon a time famous for protecting free speech, you know, it's taking the opposite ploy. Its job is to write hit pieces to end free speech. And
right.
I mean, it reminds me of one of my favorite sermons. The pastor says, you know, my elevator only goes to the first floor. If you're going to the basement, you can get off and take the stairs. And that's my attitude. The New York Times can get out of my life and take the stairs without me.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I'm amazed that anybody has a subscription to the New York Times anymore.
Why you would send an organization any money is beyond me. Do we do? If I watch other people track them and just rip the stories to shred. You know everything they're writing is a lie.
Right.
This is ridiculous.
Right. Shows you how the push to destroy free speech is as strong as the push to destroy the Second Amendment. So, and these things are conditions precedent to getting the control grid to work.
Right now, the push to destroy free speech is stronger.
Yes, I agree.
There is a war. The real war, Catherine, in my opinion, is over minds.
Yes, I totally agree.
Yeah. I mean, it is. That war is for real, and it's nasty on the First Amendment.
Right. Well, if you listen to, you know, in the car last night, Carolyn Betts was in the back seat and just describing because she'd been listening to the Monday presentations and what some
the Monday presentations meaning in front of the Supreme Court.
In front of the Supreme Court and what some of the justices said, and it was very chilling.
Well, Justice Brown in particular, like, help me out here. You mean you're trying to hamstring the federal government? It's like, yeah, that's what the Bill of Rights is, lady. That's the point of it.
But Halsey always says it was meant to bind down government.
You got to be kidding me.
Right.
That's your complaint? They're hamstringing an oppressive authority? What country did you grow up in? Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep it going. Let's turn to interest rates real quick. Japan. This next headline is almost laughable. CNN Business. Japan brings era of negative interest rates to an end with first hike in 17 years. Wow. Just end the show right there. Japan has ended its negative interest rates policy, making a historic shift away from an aggressive monetary easing program. 17 years of negative interest rates. Pretty aggressive. That was implemented years ago to fight chronic deflation. As part of the decision, Bank of Japan raised interest rates for the first time in 17 years. Look at this move. Lifting its short-term rate to around zero to 0.1% from minus 0.1%, according to the statement from the website. Holy cow.
Right. So this is the kind of central banking policy that results when you have an occupying army. I'll just be really blunt. Right. And if you look at how the G7 central banking system has used the Bank of Japan to basically finance all sorts of games around the world, it's, you know, it's a very ugly story. And it, if you're interested, it starts with Richard Werner's book, The Princess of the Yen.
It does. Yep.
Where he describes the occupying powers really making sure that they get their thumb on the Bank of Japan and assert private control over the Bank of Japan. So, but it's interesting that now finally that game is beginning to move. Well, coming out of interest rates, this is a very big deal.
So it is.
Yeah, it's a very big deal. And I want to see what happens now in Japan. Is Japan trying to assert independence, or, you know, do the G7 central banks, as they build the control grid, just want to, you know, they don't need this pie anymore?
I don't think it's an assertion of independence. I think it's part and parcel of increased interest rate environment.
Right. Right. Now,
but let's cut to a graph of the 30-year treasury and see what we got going on here.
Right. And remember, the Fed is meeting now. So. Right. They're going to make their announcement on Wednesday afternoon. And so by the time we publish this on Thursday, we will know what they say. But, you know, their target for the year was the sort of the 4% area. And, you know, rates came down and then they're headed up a little bit now. So we'll see what happens. But they're going to try and keep it in that 4% bandwidth. But there's no doubt if they take it higher, it's going to help for the disaster capitalist team will be helped by higher interest rates.
Oh, yeah. I think that we've got more of that coming for sure.
Yes.
In other words, I don't think Japan's to me still, there's nothing for me to think Japan is anything other than an appendage, and its central bank is anything other than an appendage of the Fed. And you mentioned Richard Werner and Princess of the Yen. There's also a documentary by an English filmmaker named Michael Oswald by the same title, Princes of the End. It's excellent. And Werner is the centerpiece of it, and it is great, and he's great.
Right. It was a real breakthrough on understanding central banks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Once you finish watching that, you'll know the difference between the tail and the dog and who's wagging who there, for sure.
So at the end of World War II, we left an occupying army in Germany, and we left an occupying army in Japan, and they're still there. Right?
Yeah.
That's what you need to know if you look at Japanese and current events in Germany and Japan.
Yes. Yeah. That watching Princess of the End documentary is for 2 hours or whatever it is. It's well worth the investment. You'll learn a lot.
Right. And now we're trying to extend NATO. And as we talked about last week, that means everybody has to buy Boeing planes that fall out of the sky as part of the tribute to the empire. Right.
I laugh. I should not laugh. I worked in a kitchen too long. The gallows humor is very prevalent in kitchens. I shouldn't laugh at that.
No.
Anyway, Let's, speaking of tails wagging dogs, let's turn to Elon Musk. And a story from Forbes. It's a video on what his company is up to. Here we go.
A U.S. intelligence agency has awarded a contract to SpaceX to develop a network of spy satellites in a deal worth $1.8 billion, Reuters reported, seemingly confirming reports suggesting billionaire Elon Musk's company is becoming more involved with the U.S. government.
No.
The National Reconnaissance Office agreed to a contract with SpaceX's Starshield program in 2021 to develop spy satellites for the agency, Reuters reported, citing anonymous sources familiar with the program. However, it remains unknown how many satellites SpaceX is developing for the agency and what other companies are included in the Starshield program. The satellites will have Earth imaging capabilities and will be able to operate as a swarm in low orbit, additionally enabling the U.S. to track targets on the ground and share data with U.S. intelligence and military officials, sources said.
Okay, so there you go. Any comment on that? I mean, any doubt about it?
They forgot to tell you they once have put a Neuralink mesh network in the back of your head that will hook you up to his U.S. government-funded satellites.
Yeah, right, exactly. But you know, Elon Musk, the notion that Elon Musk is this guy independent of the government is absolutely ridiculous. He's just an appendage, and it's part and parcel of the federal government. What it can't do legitimately itself, it just outsources to these companies like Twitter and Google and Tesla, whoever else. They just say, well, we can't do it, so we're going to outsource it to Elon.
Right. But starting, it's when the Reagan administration came in, you had the 47 and 49 Act. So you had a huge amount of money available to finance these kinds of projects, you know, and the defense budget going. But then you do an executive order that makes all of essentially makes it possible for private corporations to do highly classified projects. So now you've linked a capacity to borrow an infinite amount of money and use that money to drive up corporate stocks, which generates capital gains, which is the source of campaign contributions. So you've created a money printing machine that goes directly into private profit. And that's, you know, that's part of why we have so much financial methadone. It's just driving up all these stocks. You know, so if you look at Boeing stock, you've got all this money pumping through and it's driving that stock up in a way that makes anybody playing that game, it gives them the ability to outpower, you know, everybody else in the economy who has to earn their money with market discipline.
Wow.
Right.
That's, and what you just described is the best description I've ever heard of the electioneering juggernaut rigged game that I've did, how things work today.
Right. And what you're playing a game of who's got the lowest cost of capital, and you've built a machinery that can subsidize private corporations with massive amounts of, you know, negative interest rate money, right? So you've created the bifurcation you're seeing, you know, in winners and losers is a bifurcation of who's got access to that financial methadone.
It's a total access game. It's outsource sovereign functionality, drive up stock profits, recycle the money into politicians who are going to do the corporate bidding.
But as you do that, you move the most valuable technology in the world into private hands that can keep it secret and are not subject to FOIA. Right?
Yeah. Exactly. They're not subject to FOIA. There's no transparency. We're going to do it all in the dark.
Right. Taxpayers are financing a growth of a private industry that generates private profits for a select group of people. And they're using government and sovereign technology, you know, basically to take over the world. It's a coup.
Well, It's the fruit of a coup. It's the expression of a coup.
Right.
It's not the coup itself. The coup's already done deal, but that's how it expresses itself for sure.
Right. And Boeing proves the story that they're not winning because they're better. Right.
Right. The planes fall out of the sky.
Right.
But their job isn't to make planes that succeed. Their job is to boost stock profits and keep the electioneering rigged game going.
Their job is to take.
Yeah, like Pac-Man. just gobbling up. Okay, let's turn to another story. This is a bit alarming. Speaking of elections, who is from Forbes? Who is Nicole Shanahan, RFK Jr.'s possible running mate, is a tech lawyer, once married to the aforementioned Google founder, Brin. Nicole Shanahan, a tech lawyer with little political experience but a track record of donating large sums to Democratic candidates. That's who she is. What kind of donations are we talking about here? Well, she founded Clear Access IP, a tech law firm that uses AI to analyze and manage patent portfolios for clients. She also founded Bia Echo Foundation, a private foundation which invests in reproductive longevity and equality, criminal justice reform, and a healthy and livable planet. Wow. And she financed and gave donations to Pete Buttigieg and the Biden Victory Fund. What is RFK Jr. thinking if this is true?
So apparently this is the person who funded the Super Bowl ad, $4 million for the RFK. RFK is trying to get on the ballots, and I'm assuming he's on four ballots now, but he's got, 46 to go. And I'm assuming the demand for funding to get on those ballots is, because that's fantastically expensive to do that.
Oh, yeah.
And add to that the fact that the Secret Service won't provide protection. He's also got to raise money to provide protection. So, so this would be a highly unusual VP candidate for Kennedy to choose. You need somebody who wanted the jobs of the vice president. If anything happens, the president can step up and be the president. So you're looking at somebody who's never worked in federal government and is not qualified to, they're just not qualified to be the president of the United States. Right. And if you look at a campaign, if this is somebody who will fund you getting on the ballot, that gets you on the ballot. But it's also somebody that will kill you in the heartland. So if you look at how many people RFK is drawing from the Republican side, he's going to lose a lot if he does this. So I would be very surprised to see this be the candidate. He said he's going to announce on March 26th who his VP candidate is. I have a hard time. The only reason you would do this is it's what you have to do to get the money to get on the ballot. But
I can think of a second reason you would do it.
What's that?
To skew the election in favor of Donald Trump and against Biden, because you're going to suck away Biden voters and not Trump voters.
That's true. That's true. If you want to appeal to Biden voters, here's how you do it.
Yeah, that hurts Biden.
So if your job, if your goal is to help Trump, that would work.
To me, reading the tea leaves, this election is going Trump's way. This selection is headed in Trump's direction.
Well, Trump is the one who most represents the Rothschild faction.
Absolutely.
So, and the Rothschild faction is accelerating the disaster capitalism.
If he doesn't win, it means that Mnuchin is making all these moves in vain. And I don't think he is.
No.
I think Mnuchin's a connected guy.
Mnuchin is making these moves on the assumption that Trump has the election locked up. Despite the bond and the New York case and whatever.
Yeah. And then Mr. Pro-Israel himself, RFK Jr., comes in and gives you a vice president candidate that's going to siphon off voters from Biden. The tea leaves are pointing to Trump.
I don't know. Let's see what RFK does. Let's see what RFK does on March.
Hey, you know what? Maybe he doesn't select her. Maybe it turns out to be a bogus story.
Yeah. So this could just be entertainment. We don't know.
Could be. Could be. Could be a trial balloon. Could be a lot of things. There's nothing is written in ink yet.
Right. Well, I asked for a comment from the campaign and didn't get one.
Yeah. That's I don't know. I don't know what to make of that. Let's keep it going.
I think they're trying to be real tight-lipped until they make the announcement.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of Heartland, let's cut to a story about food and Tyson shuttering Iowa pork plant, impacting more than 1,200 jobs. We'll get to that number in a minute. Tyson Foods announced Monday it will close a pork plant in Perry, Iowa, which will result in the loss of 1,276 manufacturing jobs in a pork plant. I worked in plant. My plant was 300. A plant with 1,276 people is, maybe it means it's running 24/7, and it's maybe not that big, but that's a lot of jobs for one plant. Iowa remains a key state for Tyson Foods, with employment of more than 9,000 team members across our other Iowa facilities. So in other words, if you do the math here, you know, that's a big reduction in their workforce. Right. That's like 1/8 of their Iowa workforce is gone in one fell swoop. Companies such as Tyson, Smithfield Foods, and JBS Foods have offset losses by cutting costs within their operations. So in that connection, it's not really that unusual. However, Tyson alone has announced the closure of 8 facilities, including 6 chicken plants and 2 case-ready meat processing plant, as it works to boost efficiency through its manufacturing capabilities. The Perry, Iowa location would be its 9th. So what's going on? The company opened a $355 million automated bacon processing plant in Bowling Green, Kentucky. So they've taken away 9, and they're adding 1 automated facility. I don't know what to make of that, but the war on meat is on for sure.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of it either, because if you look at the population, so the rise in all-cause mortality is lowering the general population, but then immigration is adding and the net effect is plus. So your population is growing, but you're dramatically reducing the meat capability. What it looks
like.
Right.
That's what it looks like.
Now, we're also building plants to make synthetic meat, which is very, very expensive.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, it is. And the expense shows up in prices.
Right.
I mean, if you look at, you know, say, for example, Morningstar, which is a fake meat manufacturer, it's vegetable-based meat products. Those products are expensive compared to their real counterparts.
I don't know how much it matters yet. I don't know a lot about the slaughter business. One of the things I will say, John, that I'm seeing in every area of the economy, you know, so we talked about it in connection with Boeing, but it's coming up everywhere. And that is, you know, again and again, when you run an economy for decades with financial methadone, playing these different games and building a culture where 15 engineers at Boeing would go along with taking a check, even though they're making a plane they know isn't safe. What you've got is you've got a built-in level of cultural corruption and also poisoning of the population, and you're coming into a situation where you have a fundamentally corrupt and unproductive culture, and you can't, you know, across the board, your economics are going to be bad again and again and again.
Yeah. Yep. So, that's kind of where we are. And I would say that description you just provided applies with much greater force to larger companies than smaller companies. I don't see this mindset in smaller companies.
Well, but I'll give you a silly little example. Since November 1st, I've been basically renovating my home in Hickory Valley. So it's been painted, it's putting in shelves, and if you look at the number of things in a process that goes wrong and what it does to delay the time it takes to get things done and to raise the expense. So you order the dishwasher comes, you install it, it turns out the pump is broken. You have to uninstall it. You get a mess with water everywhere. You call the company. You're going to ship it back. They say no. They're going to send out a repairman, but he'll be there in 6 weeks and he will fix the pump. And so then you have to install it and try it again. You know, this goes on and on and on. It's like the never-ending journey. And
and
I cannot tell you the time it wastes. It's unbelievable. And you divide that by process, or you multiply that by process after process. And you're talking about a project that should have taken 4 months, easy, no problem. You know, God knows how long this will go on. Right. And that's just a little example, but you multiply it through all these different companies and big production facilities. You've just got a very unhealthy culture, and you've got a very unhealthy culture to do anything with.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we don't have a story on war in Ukraine this week, but I'll use Ukraine as an example. There's a NATO report recently that said Russia produces more shells than all NATO countries combined. Not by a little bit. It's 3-1.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you've got a culture where it takes a year to replace a dishwasher.
Right.
They don't.
Right.
Right. Okay, let's turn to the back to the TikTok ban and sort of the free speech aspect of it. This is the second part of the Taibbi Daily Double. Why the TikTok ban is so dangerous. Okay, let's get down to this language here. Like, zoom in on this. This is from the ban, the act, the ban. The act applies to website, desktop application, mobile application, or augmented or immersive technology application that is operated by any of, okay, and then they call them out, ByteDance, TikTok, or a covered company. Okay, that is controlled by a foreign adversary and is determined by the president to present a significant threat to national security of the United States after he issues a notice and whatever else. Okay. So Taibbi goes on. Currently, and he's right about this, the definition of foreign adversary under the law includes Russia, Iran, North Korea, and China. So you might think, well, whatever all that meant, the covered companies and controlled, it only applies to people with some ownership interest in the four countries here. However, he points out a couple of things. Number one, the bill was fast-tracked after a secret intelligence community briefing by Congress, led by the FBI, the DOJ, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. The magazine noted that if everything goes as planned, the bill will give Biden the authority to shut down an app used by 150 Americans, and here we come to the significance of 6 months, just in time for the November elections. How about that? That's point number one. Point number two is precedent. So whatever that language means, it may not matter. Because remember, in 2004, the Bush administration defined an enemy combatant as an individual who was part of supporting the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or associated with forces. Yet in oral arguments later that year, the government conceded that an enemy combatant could be a little old lady in Switzerland who wrote a check to what she thought was an orphanage. So this bill is a slippery slope once you pass this, because those definitions are going
to
change.
If you look at that language, it's very easy to make tiny changes in the language quickly, you know, in a way that's obfuscated and running through with another, like the defense authorization, and completely open up the, you know, who can be shut down by the president.
Who can be shut down? A media platform can be shut down the president based on the sort of the language there, which can be changed.
Right. And easily changed.
Yes.
So all you have to do is change that and to or, and basically you're going to be in a world where the president's going to take the position he could shut down whatever he wants whenever he wants.
Right. Right. And that's so it's a very slippery slope here. And the campaign to shut down TikTok because it's Chinese is just thoroughly misguided.
Well, here's the question. I mean, you've got the private equity players playing disaster capitalism on both sides. Right.
Yeah.
And one's saying he's going to buy it out of the other. You know, are they working together? They both want to end free speech, right?
Yeah, they both want to end free speech.
They're on the same team.
Do you think Trump is opposed to the ban on TikTok? Do you think Mnuchin's come right out and said, I'm for the ban on TikTok.
I think Trump is the candidate who will lead the Rothschild group leading the disaster capitalism.
I totally, completely agree.
If you look at the first Trump administration, you know, Trump with the pandemic and the going direct reset basically pulled off for the Rothschild syndicate a reengineering that was remarkable.
Yes.
Right. So,
yep. Mm-hmm.
So now it's double down time. So here we come.
Yep. Here we come. You can't really blame Trump for the going direct reset because, you know, the executive branch doesn't control the Fed. Congress controls the Fed. But everything else, you're exactly right.
Well, but here's the thing. The big part of the reset was shutting down Main Street so you could.
Yeah, that's true.
So Wall Street could come in. So
the monetary piece of it's not his, but everything else is, the setup is, yeah.
The monetary's not his, but the shutting down Main Street so that Wall Street can pick him up cheap.
No.
There's two parts of that play, right? And one is injecting the money so they can buy, but the other is destroying the prices so they can buy cheap.
Right. You got it. Okay. Yep. He owns that for sure.
Right. So legally they're separate, you know, and here's my problem. Once upon a time, I used to be in a room where guys would make a decision and then they'd just make the law work or they'd steamroll it. Right.
Right.
So it was one thing. They'd say, okay, you tell those guys to do this. And these guys, you know, the health guys do this and the money guys do this and everybody does this. And it's one plan. Right. And the getting the prices to drop is an important part of the plan, just like injecting the money to buy. So do you remember those? Did you ever see those old timey commercials where they'd give a housewife a shopping cart and she had 5 minutes to fill up her cart and the one who filled up the cart the most won? Right. Yeah. OK, well, that's what it's like. Right. So part of it was giving them a shopping cart. That's the money, you know, so the inject. But the other is, you know, putting everything on sale. And it was
And shrinking the size of the boxes so they fit more in the cart.
Right. And both of those were part of the going direct reset. But you played part of the game through the health regulations and the vaccines, and you paid part of the game through the monetary injection.
Yeah.
But the notion that it was some kind of complex accident that nobody understood what was happening, it's ridiculous.
That's risible.
Right. Right. You say the Rothschilds don't know what they're doing?
Please. It's ludicrous to think that.
Right.
Okay. Let's turn to, for my money, the most horrifying story of the week out of Europe. It's our only story in space, military, and global turf wars. It's one worth paying attention to from Yahoo Finance. Europe is wargaming a food crisis. Oh, Susanna, tell me more. Over 2 days in central Brussels last month, some 60 European Union and government officials, food security experts, industry reps, and a few journalists, including the guy who wrote the story, gathered to confront the possibility of something barely on the radar a few years ago, a full-blown food crisis. Groups sat down in a refurbished Art Deco shell building to simulate what might happen and help design policies aimed at prevention and response. So here we go. More new policies coming down the pike. Do tell. They talk a lot about erratic and extreme weather now regularly disturbs farming. They don't talk about how climate policies are interrupting farming. Nope. Don't talk about that. But really, to get the flavor of it, we got to scroll down to here and see. There was little objection among anybody participating to the idea that diets need to shift toward healthier options and away from meat.
The war on meat is on. If you haven't read our pharma food, you got to read our pharma food. The war on meat is on.
Is that clear enough? What's coming?
Right. So they want to replace economic meat with highly expensive synthetic.
Yeah.
Right.
You got it.
Please, if you have not read Pharma Food, everybody, please read Pharma Food. But it's unbelievable because we just published the magazine version in digital form of Dutch Farmers and Fishermen. And we describe in detail about what's being done to the European farmers. It's a brilliant presentation. And you see the whole game. And what we've been watching for 4 years is a concerted effort by the EU to destroy the farming infrastructure and to put farmers out of business, to turn their land to home building, you know, whatever. And so the notion that the EU could put this on and keep a straight face.
I know.
I couldn't keep a straight face. I could not keep a straight face.
Right. To pretend that you're setting food policy instead of trying to ruin the farmers. Like, you're trying to help them. Please.
They're trying to destroy the food supply. And it's frightening because the food supply in Europe is so superior to the United States, words cannot express. I'm driving around the United States trying to, you know, find food and eat without spending, you know, making it a full-time job to get to the farmer's market, blah, 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 blah. The quality of the food in Europe is so far surpassed to what the quality of food is in the United States. It's unbelievable. And that Europe should systematically destroy that is absolutely frightening. I mean,
that's criminal.
It's criminal. It's demonic. It's You know, I grew up in a wonderful neighborhood in West Philadelphia that was, you know, as time went on, was mostly African-American. And we used to have these old ladies, you know, who are now my age, and they would walk around saying, "It's demonic, it's demonic." And I used to think, you know, those old Black church mothers, what are they talking about? That's what we used to call them, church mothers. I said, "It's demonic, it's demonic." And now I say, you know, I'm an old Black church mother. I just walk around saying, "It's demonic, it's demonic."
Yeah, but they were right.
Demonic.
Yeah.
Right. They were right. They were right.
Yeah, they were right. And you see that in wargaming, a food crisis. Oh, God, it's terrible. Okay, let's keep it going with the Hey Robot, one story this week, but a good one. Some good nuggets in this one from biometricupdate.com. JP Morgan plans biometric payments rollout with Pop ID in 2025. They join Visa and MasterCard. Take a look at this. JP Morgan is trialing biometric payments powered by Pop ID's commercial identification with more retailers in the U.S. ahead of a planned rollout next year. The pilots include palm, fingerprint, and face authentication for payments in store. Okay? If the pilots continue to be successful, the biometric payment system will be rolled out to merchants throughout the nation later this year. Well, you just told me it was next year. But what's up? Maybe there's a difference between retail and in-store? I don't know. But JP Morgan, in any event, is pitching this system to quick service restaurants, event venues, convenience and grocery stores, though it will be made available to all. Here we go. After they enroll, this is talking about customers. After they enroll and save a payment method, a customer can use their face, fingerprint, or palm to scan or palm scan to complete their checkout at a cashier's checkout counter or self-service terminal. So face, fingerprint, or palm scan. But here's the headline. JP Morgan notes in the announcement, the Good Intelligence forecasts that biometric payments will reach 3 billion users. That's a third of the planet, and over a third, and $5.8 trillion in value globally by 2026. By 2026. So in less than 2 years, that is breathtaking.
So from January 20th on, I'm traveling. So I'm dealing with car companies, rental car companies, hotels, et cetera. And I'm trying to stay as away from the corporate infrastructure as much as possible, but I still have to use it. So I'm using it as little as I can, but I'm still using it. And what I've discovered is when you give these people credit cards, they lie about what the bill is, and then you have hidden charges.
Yep.
And if you look at the hidden charges that you can bake into the cake on what JP Morgan Chase and these companies, Visa and MasterCard, you're talking about a nightmare of hidden charges being popped onto you. I mean, that's what's happening now. And it would be a full-time job to fight them. You know, they are very much scaled so that the value of your time is such that you can't afford to fight. You know, you have to pick your fights. And this is going to be highly uneconomic. And if you look at where it's going, the next thing is they're going to want to put a chip in your hand.
And people would line up to do it.
Don't start me. I'm going to start talking about entrainment again.
Don't. Yeah. The hidden charges point is a valid one.
Oh, they're making a fortune on hidden charges. It's unbelievable. And here's what's unbelievable. You interact with a company, they play dirty tricks, and I would say material omissions and lies, you know, in terms of the economics. You know, it turns into something that wastes an enormous amount of your time. And then after it's over, you start getting emails that somebody spent a huge amount of money on an advertising firm to make and market these emails, and they're trying to sell you. And you say, why would you spend all this money marketing to me if you just destroyed the relationship with your hidden chart? You know, what's the game here? Why do you think it's worth marketing to me after you've destroyed the relationship with me as a customer?
Well, my question is, once you get these palm scans or whatever going, how do you even pick up on the public charges? What do your monthly statements look like? Do you even get any? I mean, what does this look? Are there any checks and balances in this biometric system at all?
No. Because if you have a hidden charge and you want to call JP Morgan Chase, good luck getting somebody.
But there's a threshold question, though, which is how do you detect the hidden charge in the first place?
Right. That's true. That's true. Presumably, the way you detect it is you negotiate up front as to what you're going to pay for something, and then you pay, and then the statement comes through and you discovered, oh, you paid more than you agreed you were going to pay.
With a lot of my accounts, like, you know, electricity or whatever, I log on to the computer. You know, I have a username and a password, and I log on. I can see what's going on. With bank statements, I get physical statements printed out. I can see, you know, there's transparency. With this, I just have questions about what the disclosure looks like.
Well, remember, the whole point of the control grid is taxation without representation.
Of course.
So that's where this is going, which is why I call it slavery.
Yeah.
That is where this is going.
But you saw that number in that story, $5.6 trillion by 2026.
Right.
That's a staggering number. I mean, U.S. GDP is what, $21 trillion?
They're building a control grid, and they intend to force everybody into it.
Yeah. Who needs a CBDC with you got Jamie Dimon?
Right.
You're running that.
So I've said before, they can implement this through the banking system and Visa and MasterCard without CBDCs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
It's very funny, though. I told you the Defender picked up on the story we told in Money and Markets about Powell's slippery language. And I sent you a link to it. Did a detailed story on what Powell said. You know, we're not remotely close. And then went into all the things that Fed is doing and you know, including hiring people to implement CBDC.
Yeah, right.
It's very funny. Right. It just laid out all the multiple personality disorder of the Fed talking out of both sides of its mouth about building the control grid. The Fed is building the control
grid. Watch what they do. Don't listen to what they say. Right, exactly. They're lying.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Farmageddon with a story from the Bregans. Peter and Ginger Bregan, though this is pretty much Ginger. This is a great story. It's great, but horrifying. Heroic doctor dies days after exposing deadly COVID vax component. The doctor here is Dr. Andreas Nowak. He released his final video on graphene hydroxide, a bit different than what you've heard so far. His partner explains that she suspected he was struck by some kind of directed energy weapon. So his final video, he's dead. Okay, that wasn't his first rodeo though, with trouble from the official authorities. In 2020, police raided and arrested him during a presentation. So he's giving a presentation on graphene hydroxide, and the stormtroopers come in during his presentation. 1 year later, he would die under mysterious circumstances, 3 days after exposing graphene hydroxide in the COVID vaccines. So that's what we're talking about here. His final video was in November 2021, days before a sudden mysterious death. This came to light recently, and Ginger Bregan picks up on it. So she takes another look at it. She says he was young, he was healthy, he was in his prime. And here's what he was pushing. This is what got her attention. Get to it. In his last video, he's talking about his professor, Dr. Pablo Campra. Campra studied the vaccines for the presence of graphene oxide. So that's what Campra is looking for, graphene oxide, using micro-Raman spectroscopy. It is a study of frequencies. There are frequency bands. Two of bands are important. They show that it is not graphene oxide, as he first surmised, but rather graphene hydroxide. What difference does it make? Well, he says, I would like to explain this graphene hydroxide, what it is. It's a monolayer activated carbon. It's extremely thin. The piece of this hydroxide, 50 nanometers long, but 0.1 nanometers thick. So it's 500-to-1 ratio length to thickness. These nanoscale structures can best be described as razor blades. The blood vessels in your body have epithelial cells as their inner lining. The epithelium is extremely smooth like a mirror, and it gets cut up by these razor blades, these graphene hydroxide razor blades. This is what grabs their attention. If you perform autopsies on the victims, you won't find anything, Toxicologists do their tests in petri dishes. They can't imagine that there are structures that can cut up blood vessels. There are pictures of coagulated blood coming out of the nose. People bleed to death on the inside. Especially the top athletes who are dropping dead have fast-flowing blood. The faster the blood flows, the more damage the razors will do. Whoa.
Wow. So for years, there have been questions about what I call the mysterious ingredients. So we know that there is synthetically engineered biological material in the spray. There are, you know, sort of mysterious ingredients in the food that food people, researchers have been finding. We know the Japanese found stainless steel particles in the injections. And one of the researchers who was researching the injections showed me a picture of the stainless steel particles they had found. And they looked like little sharks with jaws. It was frightening to look at them. And now we have these reports. So we know there are these unbelievably mysterious ingredients that are doing harm. So Dr. Michael Nels talked about the spike protein that basically attacks the hippocampus, breaks through the blood-brain barrier. You know, anyway, so you have all these different reports. I'm a layman. I have no idea, you know, how to sort through them in a scientific way. All I can tell you is that somebody is trying to get some pretty mysterious ingredients into our body.
Well, let me point out a couple of things about that story. It's a carbon-based product there. It's carbon, and it's on a nanoparticle scale, right? It's in fact, at 0.1 nanometers, you saw that in the thickness, at 50 nanometers long. You're talking about it's one atom thick. That's really it. So wow. That's number one. Number two, NOAC is Europe's leader. In fact, he's the only guy expert in carbon in all of Europe. So he knows what he's talking about.
Right.
When he picks up on this and it explains, hey, you know why your athletes are dying, dropping dead left and right? It's because they're processing more blood and these razor blades are sawing them off literally from the inside.
Right. And it has to be intentional.
Of course.
Right.
Of course. That's some major engineering has gone into those particles. The fact that you need a serious, serious microscope to even see these things. If you got your run-of-the-mill microscope,
you can't see
it. You don't have a prayer of seeing it. It's too small.
A pathologist way too small. Never see these.
Absolutely not.
Right.
The odds of a coroner or anybody else picking up on something that's funny are zero.
Right.
You know, you need a PhD in chemistry to operate the microscopes, basically, that would pick up on those things. Tiny. Tiny. Doing a ton of damage. Right. That's a really disturbing story. And the powers that be were on to this guy. Like I said, it wasn't his first rodeo. They came for him repeatedly, and eventually they got him.
Right.
Because they didn't they didn't really dig what he had to say. You know, he was telling the truth.
So when you kill a scientist like this, or you kill a Boeing whistleblower, it's very messy. That's why they shut down the First Amendment.
You got it.
You shut down the stuff so you don't have to kill everybody.
Yep. So we go from science kind of to, I don't know, literature. This is a Kafka-esque story. Whistleblower targeted after exposing 973% surge in heart failure among Navy pilots. A United States Navy medic who blew the whistle on an explosive report showing a massive increase in heart issues among military pilots has been blocked by the Department of Defense from accessing his work computer. It showed a bunch of other things, too. Huge increases in any number of diseases, but 930% increase in heart failure. Wow. So let's get into it. What happens? He says he's trying to report this. He's trying to run it up the flagpole internally, these increased heart failures. He says, I met with the chief of naval operations in her aid. So far, the only response to my meeting is that the DMED data has been sent to the Navy IG from the CNO's office. Here's the punchline. Slow rolling everything has been the norm, as well as denying anything that's happening. Meanwhile, at his office, according to his wife this afternoon, as Ted was nearing the end of his workday, he went to use a restroom. And when he returned, he no longer had access to his work computer, and he needs to have access to his work computer to do his job. So enough out of you, whistleblower. Shut you down.
So the way to deal with this is for everybody to just start telling the truth. You need an eruption of truth, because then it's out of control. You know, the moral of the story, everybody's got to do this. Everybody's got to do it. Right.
Okay. Exactly. Everybody's got to do this. Everybody's got to start baying like beagles about this. And that takes us right into pushback. And the pushback this week, as we talked about yesterday, is very interesting, because it's coming from, this isn't just your normal, you know, blue collar whistleblower from the ground. The pushback is creeping up and up and up and up, and it's getting really interesting.
Everybody,
we'll start with the heart.
They're on the menu.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you better be all in with the powers that be with the program. If you deviate from the program even a little bit, they will cut you off. So let's start with a Harvard professor, okay? This is from City Journal. Harvard tramples the truth. I am no longer a professor of medicine at Harvard. This guy's name is...
Martin Kulldorff.
Kulldorff, okay.
He's Swedish.
Yeah, here it is. Martin Kulldorff, okay. I'm no longer a professor of medicine at Harvard. The Harvard motto is Veritas, Latin for truth. But as I discovered, truth gets you fired. It was clear early that lockdowns would inflict enormous collateral damage, not only in education, but on public health, including treatment for cancer, cardiovascular disease, and mental health. Okay. He says on July 29th, 2020, the Harvard-edited New England Journal of Medicine published an article by two Harvard professors on whether primary schools should reopen. And they don't even mention Sweden, which didn't, you know, they didn't go with the lockdowns. He said, not mentioning Sweden is like ignoring the placebo control group when evaluating the new pharmaceutical drug. Of course, these two guys come out and say lockdowns are great, but they ignore Sweden. He said, I supported the Swedish approach myself in op-eds published in my native Sweden. But despite being a Harvard professor, I was unable to publish my thoughts in American media. And he says, my attempts to disseminate the Swedish school report on Twitter put me on the platform's trends blacklist. So censorship left and right in the U.S. I was not the only public health scientist speaking out against school closures and other unscientific countermeasures. Over in Stanford, Scott Atlas was beating the drums against closures. And he says, Kulldorff says, when 98 of Atlas's Stanford faculty colleagues unjustly attacked Atlas in an open letter, and didn't, again, they don't take him up on the merits. They didn't provide a single example of where he was wrong. I wrote a response in the student-run Daily Stanford. Part of his response is, hey, you know what? I'll debate any one of the 98 signatories who was really in favor of the lockdowns. But guess what? None of the 98 signatories accepted my offer to debate. But instead, someone at Stanford sent complaints to my superiors at Harvard who were not thrilled with me. So we won't debate you, but we will rat you out and complain about you behind your back, very cowardly. He says, and then I went on and I wrote the Great Barrington Declaration, and that's when trouble really started. Now, with the Great Barrington Declaration, it was impossible to ignore three senior infectious disease epidemiologists from three leading universities. The Barrington Declaration made clear that no scientific consensus existed for school closures and many other lockdown measures. In response, though, the attacks only intensified. All right, and we go on. You can see this guy, this is what I mean, but you got to be totally with the program. This guy is Kulldorff is pro vaccination in general. And he says, this is a tweet, thinking that everyone must be vaccinated is as scientifically flawed as thinking that nobody should. He gets in big trouble for that. That stance got me fired by Mass General Brigham and consequently fired from my Harvard faculty position. So deviate a little bit and you're gone.
Okay, but let's go back to the fundamental game here, right? The Harvard Endowment is an investment syndicate, okay? And if you look at that investment syndicate, if they were just a private company, they would have to pay taxes on their capital gains. But if they're endowment, they're free from taxes, right? So they're a tax-free operation. And if you look at the percent they spin off from the endowment to fund the university, it's a lot less than they would have to pay if they pay taxes. And the goal of the university is to provide the intellectual capital they need to be the successful investment syndicate, right? And we know in 2017 they took the endowment dark because, and this is my theory, they wanted to accelerate the disaster capitalism game. And they fired most of their in-house staff and went to outsource money managers because that's what you need to play the disaster capital game with people like Mnuchin or KKR, et cetera. Okay, that's Harvard. Now, we know that the health regulations during the pandemic was part, I believe, of the going direct reset, because to pick up all the market share on Main Street, you need to shut down Main Street, right? You need to shut down Main Street, and you need a rise in all-cause mortality because you need lower life expectancy to balance your retirement system books, right? Okay.
Yep.
So everybody's got to play ball for the investment syndicate, and the university is funded by a portion of the endowment to give you the intellectual capital you need to play that game, right? So science out, truth out, you know, we're on a roll. We need to shut down Main Street, and everybody needs to help us shut down Main Street, right? And this guy thinks he's a professor of medicine. He thinks he's a scientist, right? He thinks he's supposed to help people. He doesn't understand his job is to help the investment syndicate.
Right.
Got it?
Yeah.
So, right. And 98 people at Harvard know that their job is to help the investment syndicate.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's not about debate. It's not about science, but none of that. It's about advancing an agenda that benefits with the wealthy syndicate.
Right. Right. That's it. Yeah.
And if you're not getting with the program, you're out. Right. We don't care who you are.
Right. And if you look at this guy's credentials, it's unbelievable. He's clearly a very capable, smart guy. I mean, I disagree with him on, you know, I'm not saying he's somebody I agree with on everything, but.
Right. But he deviates even a little bit. And you're out. You're out, guy.
Well, but here's the thing.
No dissent.
He thinks he's a scientist.
No.
And what Harvard is saying is, no, you're an investment syndicate poodle.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Right. Your lane, stay in your lane. Your lane is poodle.
Right. And that's what we all have to understand. If you want to take a paycheck from these people, then you have to be a poodle. And if you don't want to be a poodle, you can't take a paycheck from them. Right?
Yeah. Right. That's exactly right. You got it. All right. Let's keep it going with pushback. Again, going up the flagpole, going up the chain. This is from the European Parliament. This is Marcel de Graaf, and he's talking about Ukraine.
So this is a Dutchman from Rotterdam, and this is not a poodle. He is not a poodle.
He's not going along with a program that tells him what he can and can't talk about.
This is what real politicians do. This is what leaders do. This is, you know, this is not a poodle.
Listen to the galley response as this guy gets into it. This is hilarious.
The galley response is the poodles, you know, yapping.
Yeah. And watch how Watch him get pulled. Watch him get yanked. Here we go. This is great.
Voorzitter, al deze rapporten over de deportatie van Oekraïnse kinderen naar Rusland zijn pure propaganda. Rusland heeft miljoenen Oekraïnse vluchtelingen opgevangen. Beetje buiten adem, sorry. Waaronder gelukkig ook honderdduizenden kinderen die door het Oekraïnse leger werden en worden gebombardeerd. Het parlement moet zich tegen deze Oekraïnse oorlogsmisdaden uitspreken. Het internationaal strafhof moet Zelensky hiervoor vervolgen. Oekraïne is bovendien zelf de grootste leverancier van kinderen voor pedonetwerken, mensensmokkel en orgaanhandel. Het heeft hiervoor kinderkennels met draagmoeders. In Rusland krijgen kinderen een traditionele opvoeding en opleiding. In het Westen krijgen ze transgender indoctrinatie, hormoonblokkers en genitale verminking. De hypocrisie is hemeltergend. Het Westen moet ophouden met deze oorlogshitserij.
Next speaker.
I cut his mic. That's unbelievable. You hear that? That's shame on you.
It's, you know, for a Dutchman of his generation, what is happening right now is so shocking and appalling. And what he just did was unbelievably courageous. So, yeah. And he's one of the group in the Forum for Democracy. So last year I spoke at the Forum at their big annual meeting. And, you know, and we've supported them off and on as much as possible in the Netherlands. And, you know, they just keep trying to tell the truth. And the truth is shocking. And you can tell it's very dangerous to tell the truth. He was scared.
He's having trouble breathing there.
Right.
You know, he's scared. That's how I read that.
But he's in the hero's pack at Solari, so.
Yeah, he should be. That was a worthy performance. I mean, he fought his nervousness and just delivered the goods. Good for him. Love a guy. Love that guy.
If you look at what the U.S. is supporting being done to children in the Ukraine, or children in Israel, or children in Gaza, or children, you know, if you look at what we as taxpayers are financing, we are financing genocide and things that are worse.
Yes. Yeah. Big time.
That's our money.
Oh, let's go back to the U.S. And again, the pushback is moving up. To some wealthy people. This is about NBA legend John Stockton suing the Washington AG's office over COVID bans. If you don't know who John Stockton is, let me tell you who he is. This is the NBA's all-time career leader in assists. Get a look at this. Okay, here's a chart from Statista of assists. You see Stockton out here? Let me zoom in on this. Stockton is way out in front. I mean, this is 15,800 rebounds. The next guy's got 12,000. This is like Secretariat versus donkeys, except they're not donkeys. They're the best player in the game, but they're just not John Stockton. This guy's incredible. And Stockton is an old school player. Look at this. Remember when baggy pants came into the league? Uh-huh. Stockton was having none of that. He's like, no, I'm going. Absolutely not. He was a ferocious competitor. Uh-huh. He would pull up. You know, all the other players are pulling up in Lambos and, you know, Maseratis and stuff. Stockton drove a minivan. He's just a tough, hard-nosed, old-school player. And now he's suing the Washington AG's office. So let's cut back to that. Basketball legend John Stockton has taken his disdain for COVID-19 restrictions to a federal courtroom, initiating a lawsuit with other plaintiffs, which are doctors, so they have standing, against Washington State Office of the Attorney General over pandemic rules that restrict doctors from speaking against the mainstream COVID narrative. So Stockton, not being a doctor, enlists the help of other plaintiffs so he doesn't get bounced for lack of standing. Rick Jaffe, one of Stockton's attorneys on the case, said the case is about free speech. Does the medical board have the constitutional authority to investigate, prosecute, and sanction doctors for writing articles, posting blogs on websites, and speaking out in public, even if the government or the medical board thinks what they're saying is wrong or dangerous? And get this, Jaffe said he's represented other cases on the same issue in California, where a judge ordered a preliminary injunction halting the implementation of free speech restrictions. So that's awesome. Good for the judge and good for John Stockton.
Right. And this goes to the heart of the Merrill Nass case and other cases, Paul Thomas, where we've seen doctors, you know, absolutely targeted by their medical board for telling the truth and speaking publicly. So losing their licenses all over the country.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, the powers that be, when you get a guy like John Stockton involved and Kennedy's on that case, too, you know, now you've got well-heeled plaintiffs.
Right.
The doctors themselves, I'm sure, aren't hurting for money. Now you got a problem on your hand because you got an opponent who knows how to push back and knows how to play your game.
Right.
And now as much as you want to avoid the merits, now you're going to get your nose rubbed in the merits,
right,
whether you like it or not.
And I can't tell you how many people I've met who went to Harvard, you know, who thought it was a university and didn't realize it was an investment syndicate. And they're not on board. They're not on board for the investment syndicate to destroy science.
Good. Yeah. Anyway, so the pushback is very interesting this week because it's creeping higher and higher. The number of people on the royalist teams is dwindling at an alarming rate. It's a foot race.
If you're very wealthy, you're on the menu.
Yeah.
If you look at the disaster capitalism that's coming, you're on the menu.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
That is it for Pushback and for Stories. So let's wrap up. We covered a couple charts, but let's move on to the remaining charts, starting with the S&P. What do we have here?
Very quickly, the U.S. still in the lead. You know, every year we look at the fundamentals and say, you know, Europe and the emerging markets should pull ahead. This week, instead of looking at the Chinese stock market, I used emerging markets. But remember, China is a big piece in that and dragging the emerging markets down. So S&P for the year up 9%, European index up 4%, and the emerging markets in the positive. China's still negative if we look to China. So equity the planet equity scenario continues to be on.
Yeah. U.S. still in the lead, like you say. Okay. Safety trade. Look at this.
So, you know, bonds flat, and we'll see what the Fed does with interest rates. That will be important to bonds. And gold and silver up for the year. So silver is improving. You know, silver has really been in the doghouse. So
and Catherine just stacks more and more silver.
Right. So the worst silver was getting, but, you know, if silver is going to rise this much, I don't know, maybe I should slow down my buying. Anyway.
Okay. And wrapping it up, the doghouse this week is, oh, good old Bitcoin.
Bitcoin's been on quite a roll. And 63,000 is now below the pump high in the pandemic pump, but we saw it go into the 70s. And I don't think the pump is over, so I think this is just probably a consolidation.
I mean, even on the year, look, I mean, it starts at 44,000. That's still a huge gain.
Well, it's a huge gain. It you know, it was down at below 20,000 at the end of the dump. So I don't see why the pump would be over before the election.
No, I don't.
As Carol always says, secret money for secret armies. Why would they give it up?
Yeah. Right. Right. Okay, that's it for charts. Solari in-house this week, interesting lineup. Here we go. Speaking of free speech.
Yeah, so free speech is the topic. There's no doubt about that. And Sean Buckley is the attorney, the Canadian attorney, who has run the National Citizens Inquiry that's so amazing. So Sean Buckley has run the National Citizens Inquiry. And there is new legislation basically proposing minority report laws so you can basically penalize or arrest somebody for what you think they might say. And so we decided we wanted, given the Supreme Court case this Monday and the other things happening with free speech in the United States, we figured, okay, Sean's great on Canada, and we needed to have a little conversation about, you know, the attack on free speech and how it relates to financial freedom. One of the interesting things Sean said was, if you look at what's going on in Canada and their legal structure, they are really looking to the United States to pull this one out. So if free speech is to be protected, they are hoping the Americans do. And if Americans do, then they feel they can. But they need the Americans to absolutely lead and win on this one. So,
huh. That's interesting. Very interesting.
Well, if you look at the law, we have the best chance. I mean, if you look at how the law and the legal system works, and I think America has the best chance in the world of leading, you know, the protection of free speech now.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, you know, we've gotten some wins. You just saw the Stockton article, the judge in California, a preliminary injunction against the powers that be. It's great.
Courts follow culture. If the American people insist on free speech, we win.
Yeah. Yeah. So, right.
You know, this comes down to you and me. So let's start talking, you know.
However, we must note that the questioning in yesterday's Supreme Court argument in the case that originated with Judge Doughty in Louisiana they're not looking so good. Although it could come out a split decision. It could be 5-4, 6-3.
So this is an election year. Right. So we have a huge portion of the population globally, 4 billion people voting. We just had Putin win, 88% of the vote. So Russia had a vote. India has a vote coming up. You know, election time is when people get together and they reestablish what the culture is all about. And what we should all do this year during the election is make it clear free speech. Free speech is important. We want free speech. So,
Totally agreed.
Right.
Okay, let's keep it going in-house. This another an odd in-house entry this week. NC should be first in financial freedom from the Carolina Journal. And you look down like, okay, what's going on here? And you see, wait for it. Here we go. You got this guy, Jim Bergen. He's a senator in North Carolina. The agenda, there's a meeting with Catherine Austin Fitz, the author of the Solari Report, former manager Dylan Reed. So what's going on with this?
So we had a wonderful subscriber when we had the event, the meet and greet in Raleigh, who arranged for Jim Bergen for us to meet and brief him and a group that he gathered on financial transaction freedom. And it was a remarkable group. And one of the things he did was he invited Jeff Moore, the deputy editor of the Carolina Observer. And I remember when I realized that a reporter was there, I thought, you know, because I'm used to media's running. If you're talking about financial freedom, the media's running a hit on you, right?
Right.
But this guy listened very carefully, you know, so the presentation was, what is the control grid that's coming? How does it affect financial freedom? You know, and what can a state legislature and bank? There's a wonderful banker from a community bank in North Carolina who was there. You know, what can the banking community and the state do to protect financial freedom? And it was a very rich, intelligent conversation. And what was remarkable was that this guy wrote an article, and I was very impressed because what he laid out was, it is important for North Carolina to do this, to establish and protect financial freedom. Now, that sounds like a simple thing, but as you go around the country and you talk to legislators and bankers about this, the question is, number one, who sees the problem? You know, who sees the control grid coming? And then number two, who will take responsibility and own it? And what this guy lays out is basically a message that says, this problem is coming and we should own it and we should be first in financial freedom. And just laying out that charge is a huge contribution. If you're me and you're trying to talk to legislators, having someone like the Carolina Observer say to leaders in North Carolina, you know, we need to be first here.
Yeah.
A little thing, but that's how all reform starts. Because if you're a legislator and you look at what it takes to protect financial freedom in this environment, it's a daunting task. It's a daunting task. And the first thing you need is you need, you know, a vision that, okay, this is something we should do and we need to do. And I can't tell you what it means to have, you know, an important local paper say that. Anyway.
Yeah.
This guy listened and he read the material and he got it. And I was
impressed. Right.
You know, I'm not used to media caring about the real deal. So.
Yep.
Anyway.
Okay. Let's keep it going back to the legal front with pushback of the week, Ray Flores.
So Ray Flores does a tremendous amount. He's a key attorney in the CHD network. And he's been listening to Carolyn Betts and me on Financial Rebellion or on the CHD calls talking about the importance of cash and money. He absolutely has embraced it. And, you know, coming from the healthcare side, now he's doing litigation for cash. And he found he connected up with plaintiffs who'd been essentially, you know, kept out of the national parks because they wouldn't accept cash.
Right, which we covered last week.
Right. He's doing the National Park Service. And this is a great thing to see. This is the integration of the health team with the financial team and understanding that health freedom and financial freedom are one kind of freedom and very integrated. The other team
they're very integrated.
Right. The other team, the disaster capitalism team, is playing on an integrated basis. We can too.
Right. So it's good to have a guy like Flores gets it because he's effective.
He's effective, yeah.
Okay, let's keep it going in-house. This is interesting. Three tips to help you dive into the Solari report.
This is not my nature, but we have a welcome page, and one of the things we're discovering is new subscribers come in. Please make sure you check out the welcome page because you have access to a wealth of information, and it will help you understand what you get for your subscription and how to use it. So we really want to encourage you to check out the welcome page. And the other thing is that, you know, if you want help navigating the website, feel free to call customer service. Just put in a support ticket and we'll have somebody call you and walk you through. So don't be a stranger, but make sure you understand what's available, because there's a great deal of information available. And if you're a new subscriber, sometimes it can seem overwhelming. So please check out the welcome page.
Yeah, there is a ton of information. Okay, and finally, meet and greet. The tours of Catherine Austin Fitz across U.S. keeps rolling. Who's next?
So we were in Ohio yesterday with Carolyn Betts and Ricardo Oskam, and we're going to be in Malvern, Pennsylvania on Saturday. And we also have a meeting with the CHD Philadelphia in Devon as well on Friday night. So come out to Devon. Or we've shut off the sales for the Radnor Hunt Club on Saturday. So, but they're going to be 60 great subscribers there, and we look forward to seeing you there.
How many?
60.
Wow. That's a great turnout.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and there's a dress code. We put out an announcement, but please make sure to obey the dress code. We don't want you, you know, we don't want to lose you just because you disobeyed the dress code. The meet and greet schedule is at the top of the website. So if you want to know where we're going to pop up next, go check out the meet and greet schedule.
Yeah. And there's one coming up in Idaho. They're all over. Yeah.
Sandpoint. I'm going to South Dakota, Sandpoint. I'll be in Fort Myers, Florida. It's all up for meet and greet. Anyway.
Yeah, that's great. That's good you're doing this. I love
Alabama. Alabama, what's next? Oh, the one that's exciting, Richard Warner is coming on April 2nd to brief the Tennessee legislature. And, you know, if you are from surrounding states and you want your legislators in on that briefing, we're happy to include them. So let us know. Okay?
All right.
Yeah. You getting ready? Are you working your way up with your next video to come brief the Tennessee legislators?
Yeah, as soon as I get off this podcast, I'm gonna jump on my bike and finish shooting. I've got a few little patch things to shoot, a little B-roll, but okay. the video's coming.
Well, yeah. I'm trying not to ask questions or pressure you.
I hesitate to tell you the title because I haven't told you the title, and it's kind of shocking, but I'll tell you anyway.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Janet Yellen needs to be arrested for urinating on the rule of law in public. Okay, I'm going with that title. I was unsure about it. But the fact that you're not horrified tells me I'm on the right track.
So are you going to say needs to be or should be arrested?
Needs to be.
I would say should be.
You know what? I'm really up against the. I'm going to play with it because there's a character limit on YouTube titles of 70 characters.
Uh-huh.
I'm at 70.
Oh.
So any kind of. Anyway, and I got to drop Janet anyway. So I'm going to roll with that.
Can I make a suggestion?
I've done the thumbnail. As long as it doesn't involve changing the thumbnail, I busted.
You just need to make sure you get in that $7 trillion figure that she says she's going to collect in back taxes and fees.
Not this video.
I'm just telling you, that will tremendously up the willingness of people to feel she should be arrested.
let me back up. I'm changing directions a little bit in my videos to do shorter videos.
Ah, okay.
On like discrete legal topics, this one being the rule of law. And I can get to the $7 trillion in another video pretty easily. So I'm going to cover things like rule of law. The next one will be Fed independence, and I'll go from there.
Okay, well, all I can tell you is when I tell audiences that Janet Yellen said that one of the reasons we can afford two wars is we have essentially the U.S. Secretary has an accounts receivable from the American people of $7 trillion. You should see their faces. I mean, the impact is unbelievable. And I point out to them, you know, actually, the U.S. Secretary has a receivable. We have a receivable from the U.S. Secretary for $21 trillion, so we can assert a relative offset.
Right. Let's get into an offset game, Janet.
Absolutely. You know, 21 trillion is a lot more than seven, right?
Big time. And it's not just 21 either.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Okay, John, great week. Next week is the week then we're free to think. And you finish your video, hopefully.
Yep, it'll be out. Yep, coming soon. Okay, Monday.
I just can't imagine what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks.
A lot of stories. That's what's going to happen.
Yep, yep. Although I do want to say this. We just met with a wonderful group of people in Ohio and a beautiful agri community. So instead of having a golf course in the middle of all the beautiful homes, they have a farm. You know, what a great idea. It's on a beautiful piece of land. We had 25 subscribers, mostly from Ohio. A few came across the border from Kentucky. And when you see what happens when you get a group of people who understand what's going on and are taking positive action in their lives or in the community or in their state or whatever, and they get together and they start focusing on, you know, part of the conversation was how do we focus on taking positive action with the people who understand what's happening and want to do something about it and keep in that lane instead of trying to fight with people who don't want to know what's going on or don't want to do anything about it and you know, focus our efforts. What you realize is there's just tremendous positive things going on. And so we meet and there are all these fabulous people from the Cincinnati area. And Carolyn was like, wow, we just have to find each other. You know, go find your tribe. It's there. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, great week. We will see you in a fortnight. John, good luck with your video. I love the title.
Thank you, Catherine. See you in a fortnight.
Goodbye.